Welcome, everybody. This is the second lecture of the Mises Academy class on the sovereign debt crisis. So tonight we're going to be talking about, this is more of the most theoretical of the lectures for this course. And what we're talking about today is just a brief overview of the formation of the euro and then the theory of what's called optimal currency area. So that's the actual name of this topic in mainstream neoclassical economics. So as far as the formation of the euro here, this is pretty standard stuff that Paul Krugman talked about this in the article I assigned. And then also, if you go to Wikipedia and look at a few things, this is where you get this sort of thing. Let me just give a plug for the Krugman article. I know some of you may be short on time, pressed for time, and if you see a list of readings and you think, well, okay, I'm only going to read a couple of these things, so I'll read Mises, and then why would I waste time reading Krugman? In general, yes, that's a good strategy to adopt, but for this particular week's material, actually, if you were going to read just one thing, I would point you to the assigned Krugman reading, because he really does a good job of laying out in easy-to-understand terms and arguments what the mainstream approach to optimal currency area is, even though I don't think he uses that phrase because he's trying not to intimidate the reader with big words. So anyway, let me just give one more plug for that if you want to understand how the mainstream thinks about this stuff, Krugman's piece is actually pretty good, whereas the stuff you're going to read in Mises is awesome too, but I'm guessing a lot of you already are familiar with that perspective, so that you might not learn that much new except for Mises' proposals for how a country goes back on gold once it's been off gold. Okay, just for those of you who, like me, are not up to speed on what happened in Europe, and for this, a lot of American listeners, some of this stuff is going to be new information, whereas for those of you who are tuning in from Europe, of course, this is going to be standard stuff. So the euro was formally opened its doors for operation, if you will, began on January 1st of 99, but at that point it was just like an electronic or a virtual currency is what some people refer to it as, right? So it would be in terms of your bank accounts and financial transactions and things, but it wasn't the actual, people still were walking around with pieces of paper issued by their governments, lira, mark, that sort of thing, the French franc, and those at that point, in terms of finance and economics, those things were considered denominations of the euro. That's how they handled that stuff in terms of the transactions. And then on January 1st of 2002, they actually, people started walking around with actual euro notes. So as of right now, there are 17 states in the eurozone that are, for which it's the official currency. And then it's unofficially used by four other states, and then 10 countries peg their currencies to the euro. And let me just make a note for basically ignorant Americans. Don't get confused. The eurozone is not the same thing as the European Union. All right, so there are countries that are in the European Union that do not have the euro as their currency. So, for example, Great Britain is in the European Union, but it doesn't have, the euro is not the currency in Great Britain. The British pound is. All right, so just keep that distinction in mind. Don't get mixed up. Okay, there are these criteria that were set forth in the 92 treaty to establish, that lay the groundwork for the eventual, coming together, integration of the European nations, part of which was the adoption of a common currency. And so they had these list of criteria, but it's sort of like if someone right now looked at the United States government and what it did and then looked at the Constitution and said, oh, these are the criteria for what's permissible action by the U.S. government, and that would obviously not be true. It's a similar thing here, that if you go to Wikipedia and type in an Euro criteria or convergence criteria, and you find this list, and it has a neat little chart showing which countries are satisfying these various criteria, which countries that are using the euro currently. And so you can see it's I'm not even sure if it's 50% in terms of the various criteria. And in terms of, is there any country that satisfies all the criteria? I didn't look that carefully, but I don't think so. Maybe one or two does. All right. So the point is this, even though these were the rules, you have politics as usual, and well, let me just back up and make sure you get the idea here. So politically, the problem is you have states like Germany that obviously have a history with hyperinflation, and so that's why nowadays the German finance minister and the people in the German government and just the German people in general, if you want to make stereotypes, are hawks when it comes to inflation, whereas people in other European countries aren't nearly as concerned about that. They might, you know, on the spectrum, lean more towards printing more money if they thought that would ease social problems, whereas the Germans, because of their history, obviously, are very concerned and they don't want to debase their currency. So when you start talking about, hey, let's merge in order to have the benefits of a common currency and, you know, let's reduce trade barriers and do this sort of thing because that's what the U.S. has. Right? So this is the rationale behind all this, and some of this comes out in the Paul Krugman piece. But part of what's going on here is the idea was that, okay, divided, you know, the individual European countries were isolated. That we, you know, had these silly trade barriers erected against each other. We have all different currencies, so it's hard to conduct business within Europe because every time you cross this political boundary, then, you know, you have to change currencies and so forth. So we're at a serious economic disadvantage compared to the United States, which is a humongous free trade zone internally, right? There's not tariffs in the state of Florida levied against the state of New York. You can't do that. And so the U.S., you know, among the other reasons for why the U.S. such an economic powerhouse historically, part of it is it's a giant free trade zone internally, and it has a common currency. And so that, you know, the people in Europe were saying, the you know, elites, the intelligentsia, and the people that were behind this drive for the euro and for economic integration more generally, they were saying, what we need to do is be like the United States. We need to get rid of our internal trade barriers against each other, allow for, you know, the free movement of labor and capital as well as goods, and, you know, harmonize our tax rates, that sort of thing, so that you don't have businesses going from one country to another, and, you know, harmonize our unemployment benefits, stuff like that, so that, you know, if one country is very generous in its social programs, and then you're reducing immigration barriers so that labor can move freely, well, then that country's going to be in trouble. You know, then they're going to, you know, all the unemployed people are going to move to them and get on their dole. And so, you know, that's you have to be careful with all that stuff. And then also let's have an integrated, you know, a single currency. And then we'll be able to compete. The Eurozone or the European Union will be able to compete with the Union of American States, commonly known as the United States. So that's the idea behind this, the big picture. So the problem, though, is you start merging your economies with other economies and you start, you know, falling under the same umbrella, well, then you get nervous. Like, so if you're the Germans, you're a little bit leery about going on a common, you know, not using the mark anymore, which your central bank can control, and then using the euro, which is issued by the European Central Bank. And yes, you're going to have a voice in its policies, but you're not going to dictate it unilaterally. You're going to have to share the decision-making power with the, you know, the Spanish and the Italians and whoever else is using the thing, the Greeks. And so that's the concern. So they didn't want some, you know, freeloader country joining either the European Union or more specifically adopting the euro, and then if it's got all these problems. So that's what the point of these criteria is that they want to make sure only fiscally sound, responsible governments are allowed to join this thing, so that one bad apple doesn't pull down everybody else. Okay, so these criteria were things like price inflation no more than 1.5 percentage points higher than the three best performing members of the EU. The ones that are particularly funny because so many people are violating them right now is maximum government deficit of 3% of GDP and government debt of 60% of GDP. And I have in here Greek fraud. So this is one of the issues where in the last few years the Greek government got into such trouble is it turned out, you know, they were reporting to the European Union authorities that they were in compliance with these things, with these targets. But then it turned out, you know, when the government switched hands and there was a changeover, and they said, whoa, actually, they were cooking the books. Okay, and that's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, we can get into if people are interested in the Q&A, or I'll go, you know, get you some links and post it to you. But how they were using derivatives and things like that to hide how much debt the Greek government was actually accruing, right? So officially they were reporting that they were within these targets, but actually they were totally off. So let me just give you an example. I just right before class just Googled Greek government fraud. And so this is a story from January 13th, 2010. And it says, the European Commission on Tuesday accused Greece of statistics fraud, while the new finance minister says there's no skeleton in the closet. And the report focused on Greek statistical data and methodological problems that arose between 2004 and 2009. So this was the paragraph that I thought was pretty funny. In October, the new Greek socialist government estimated its 2009 deficit will be 12.5% of gross domestic product, up from the 3.7% predicted in April. Okay, so in April, the government had predicted the GDP, the deficit in terms of GDP that year would be 3.7%, and then a few months later in October, you know, the government switched hands. But actually, our deficit this year is going to be 12.5% of GDP. And so that's kind of a big discrepancy. But the problem with this stuff, and this is why the critics were, at the time, you know, before the euro was adopted and even afterwards, there were these critics, and this is one of the things they brought up. We're just like sort of public choice problems and saying, yeah, you guys can have all these criteria, but what happens if you let a state in and then it starts violating them? What are you going to do? But you don't want to kick the state out, because that's going to be perceived as a failure of the euro project. And of course that's exactly what is happening now, that you got all these states that are only very loosely hitting some of these criteria. And so what are they going to do? Just kick them all out? You know, so it's that sort of issue of just in general how political structures don't end up doing what they claim they're going to do. And then there's a few more things that, you know, there's no point in us going over them, just showing you what the official criteria were. So if you're interested in this and you want, like I say, it's kind of funny, if you want to see the adherence rates to these various criteria, just go to Wikipedia and look up Euro criteria for adoption or Euro convergence criteria, and that should take you to the right page. All right, before we jump into the theoretical analysis of optimum currency areas, the way that a mainstream economist would look at it, we should probably review a few different types of monetary regimes, because in a lot of the discussion, especially if you're reading a Krugman piece, you might get a little bit confused. And so let me just quickly go over three main types of currency regime. Okay, so one main thing is the classical gold standard. So for those of you who have taken a lot of my classes before, this is review, but I can't assume everybody knows this. So under the classical gold standard, so this would be like before World War I, what you had was all these different countries had their own respective currencies, right? So the United States government had the U.S. dollar, and the French had the franc, and Germany had the mark, and Great Britain had the pound, and so forth. But the countries that were on the gold standard, what they did is they, I don't even want to use the term peg, because peg makes it sound like it was a temporary thing, where, back then, I mean, they would legally define their currency in terms of a certain weight of gold or silver, when they were on a silver standard, all right? So it wasn't like it was a target of monetary policy, okay? So that it wasn't, how nowadays, Ben Bernanke will say, oh, well, our target is to keep core inflation below 2%, around 2%. That's our target, keep it below there, but we don't want it to go to deflation either. So we want to keep core inflation between 1% and 2%. That's our target. But it's not like if core inflation comes in at 2.3%, Bernanke's going to get fired or he's going to get fined or something. He's like, oh, we're a little bit above target, so maybe we should tighten up a little bit at our next meeting. You see what I'm saying? So that it's not like it's a formal legal commitment that they're making. Whereas on the classical gold standard, it wasn't like there was some number that they picked, and then if things got a little awkward, maybe they would change the number 2 months later and change the exchange rate. That's, that was like a big deal. Like, you were violating your contracts if you did that. So, Mises doesn't even like the term peg, because he thought the introduction of that term peg, like when you say, oh, nations would peg their currency to gold, after World War I and after things started getting real loosey-goosey, Mises didn't like that term, because he said, no, he liked the term redeem, that your currency was redeemable in gold, to stress the fact that it wasn't some arbitrary intention or desire of the monetary authorities, but it was a promise they were making, that what our currency is a thing, tickets that give you a certain amount of gold. They're claims on gold. That's the way Mises thought people should be thinking about it, not that you have this independent fiat currency that, if it's convenient, will peg to gold. So, for example, this is pre-World War I. You had, they didn't actually define it this way. They defined it in terms of grains and things like that. But the way it worked out is roughly, if you had $20.67, that would get you an ounce of gold. So the idea is the U.S. government was pledging anybody, not only another central bank, but also the average citizen can come up to us, the treasury or whatever, and give us $20.67 in U.S. currency, green pieces of paper or coins and so forth, and then we will give you an ounce of gold. And we pledge to do that. And then we go the other way too. If you wanted the currency, you could give them an ounce of gold and they would give you the currency. Now, in practice, there was a slight band around that because of seniorage, that you had to pay a little bit more in currency to get the ounce of gold, and you wouldn't get it quite back if you went the other way, right? But the official, except for those, cost of handling or handling fees, whatever you want to call them, it was basically you had $20.67 and you were legally entitled to an ounce of gold. And for the British pound, it was 4.25 pounds for an ounce of gold. So what that meant is, since all the governments were redeeming their own currencies for a fixed weight of gold that investors believed wasn't moving anywhere, that was it forever, set in stone, then the currencies had these natural long-run exchange rates against each other. So, for example, the U.S. dollar to the British pound, the natural exchange rate there would be $4.86 would exchange for one British pound. So in the foreign exchange markets, that was like the natural anchor point. So what happens is, if a country starts printing too much money, there's a self-correcting mechanism. There's a feedback loop where it would start having its gold reserves taken out of the country. And so then that would put pressure on the government. They would realize, if we keep up this inflationary policy, we're going to run out of gold. And then everyone's going to realize we've been too profligate. You know, it would be very embarrassing. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be discredited in the eyes of the investors of the world. And so just, you know, to make this stay on the gold standard, it kept you honest, at least relative to everybody else. You could not, one country could not unilaterally start inflating its currency more quickly than everybody else who was on the gold standard, because if you did, then that would set up arbitrage opportunities and speculators would attack your currency, and gold would leave your vaults and go into the vaults of other countries that were being more responsible with their printing presses. So that it kept everybody in line. So all right, let me just finish this point, and then I'll come back to that one just to spell that mechanism out a little bit. So the last point I make on this slide is to say under the classical gold standard, sometimes critics, like people like Matt Iglesias and guys like that, if you know who he is, they try to, like recently Matt Iglesias, for those of you who don't know him, he's this young guy who's, for some reason, really popular. Calls himself a progressive leftist, and he regularly writes hit pieces on Ron Paul. And so one of his things lately is to say Ron Paul calls himself a libertarian, but he's in favor of the government fixing the price of gold. So what kind of free market guy is he? He believes in price controls. And what he's talking about is that Ron Paul, of course, even though right now it's not really that he favors the gold standard per se, but Ron Paul, of course, historically liked the classical gold standard and thought when Richard Nixon closed the gold window, that was a dark day in U.S. history. So, it's Matt Iglesias. I'll type it out. So it's spelled Y-G-L-E-S-I-A-S. So if you Google him, he'll pop up. He's has a very popular blog. But like I say, it's funny because it's not like he's got an economics PhD and he's teaching somewhere. He's just some guy that, I don't know, was the right place at the right time and started writing stuff, and he got popular. Now, he's a clever guy, but my point is, you understand why Paul Krugman's got a microphone, but why does Matt Iglesias have a microphone on economic issues? Who knows? So, let's see. That was his criticism of Ron Paul, saying Ron Paul believes in government fixing prices instead of letting supply and demand determine them. And so let me just clarify that's largely inaccurate. All right, that's not the way to think about it. All right, so when you talk about standard price controls, like the government of New York City fixing the price of setting maximum rents, what does that mean? If they say, in this neighborhood, you can't, for a one-bedroom apartment, you can't charge more than $800 a month, what does that mean? Well, they just declare that, and if anybody gets caught charging more than $800 a month, they will send guys with guns to your place and fine you, and if you don't pay the fine, those guys will come and throw you in jail. Okay, under the classical gold standard, when we say that the price of an ounce of gold quoted in dollars was $20.67, it's not because the government was going to punish you if you paid too much or too little for an ounce of gold. You can do whatever you want. It was the government was placing handcuffs on itself. The government was saying to people, announcing to the world, if you give us $20.67, we will hand you an ounce of gold out of the stockpile we've accumulated and that we're storing in our vaults. Or if you want us to issue more dollars and give them to you, we can do that too if you give us an ounce of gold and we'll give you $20.67. Okay, so given that the U.S. government is doing that and they have this humongous stockpile of gold to back up their pledge, investors around the world, when they're trading gold against dollars, they would be silly to deviate from that price because one party is, you know, is getting a worse deal than he could get if he dealt directly with the U.S. government. So that's the way you kept the price centered around the official target, or whatever you want to call it. It wasn't because it was an actual price control backed up by government force. So let me just talk very quickly about how this mechanism works. So let's say Great Britain is running the printing press too much. They're printing too many British pounds. So there's very, depending on the assumptions you want to make as how this thing plays out, you know, there are different ways this would manifest itself. So, but I'll just go one way that's plausible. So there's more and more British pounds floating around in Great Britain. So that starts raising the prices of goods and services in Great Britain, right? The actual numbers on price tags, you know, to buy food or buy tea or get your hair cut, what have you, before it costs a certain amount for the British people paying pounds to their merchants, and now those numbers are going up because the Bank of England is printing too many pounds. So what happens now is people in Great Britain who are going to use internationally traded goods are going to see that it's now cheaper to import stuff from, let's say, the United States than from the British producer, so long as the exchange rate is the original amount of $4.86 to one British pound. And so they're going to stop buying stuff from British producers, like agricultural products, let's say, and they're going to start importing them from the United States. Because remember, prices in general in Britain are going up because the Bank of England's printing so many pounds, whereas the American authorities, the Federal Reserve, is being more responsible and isn't inflating as much. Okay, so the British price of things is going up. The dollar price in the United States isn't going up as much. At the original exchange rate, that means now the stuff is relatively cheaper and cheaper in the United States. So the British importers start importing stuff. So what that does is, it's other things equal, that's going to make the actual exchange rate in the foreign exchange market start moving, right? Because now all these British people want to import more stuff on net from the United States. And then vice versa, too. People in the United States who before were importing stuff from Great Britain, because now they're getting more expensive, they don't want it as much, right? So there's this trade deficit that's arising between the two countries. So what happens, that means now there are people who are trying to take British pounds and then trade them for dollars, because the British people want to, you know, buy U.S. stuff, and there's not as many Americans who want to buy British stuff. So that means in the foreign exchange markets, where it's set by supply and demand, now the price, the dollar price of the pound is going to start dropping, right? The dollar is going to strengthen against the pound. So instead of being 4.86 for a pound, maybe it goes down to 4.80 for a pound. So what happens, though, is as the exchange rate starts moving away from that long-run anchor, you know, like the natural exchange rate of 4.86 for a pound, then eventually, once it moves away far enough, then even considering shipping costs and the premium that the governments charge when you're converting, at some point you hit what's called the goal export point. And it makes sense for speculators to take British pounds, turn them into the British government for gold, ship the gold across the ocean, and then take the gold and give it to the American authorities and get your dollars back. All right? So if you just think through, you can write some numbers. If you want to actually do it yourself, you can write out some numbers and just show that, you know, if, so for example, let's say it goes, you know, to $4, you know, a huge swing. $4 gets you one British pound because of these, you know, this huge trade deficit, and all these British importers are trying to turn their pounds into dollars to be able to get American goods. So now, if you're somebody in the United States with a bunch of dollars and you're a speculator, what can you do? You can go into the foreign exchange markets take your $4, get one British pound with it, take your British pound to the British government or the Bank of England, and say, oh, well, you take, get $4 and 4.25 pounds, give me an ounce of gold. Then you ship the ounce of gold across the ocean, turn it over to the Treasury or the Fed, and get $20.67. Okay, and then you're going to end up with more dollars than you started out with. So that's the kind of thing that was going on, or that would happen if the Bank of England is inflating more quickly than the Federal Reserve is inflating. And so then notice what would happen there. In order, so, that, so from the speculator's point of view, he's just taking his original amount of dollars and turning them into more dollars. That's the whole point of it. Like whatever, and for, that's also true for speculators around the world and their own currencies. So they're just perceiving that when the British pound's exchange rate against their own domestic currency moves far enough away from this long-run anchor point, then there's an arbitrage opportunity. So they go ahead and do that. But notice what they're doing. In the attempt for them to seize this, exploit this possibility, they're turning British pounds into the Bank of England and getting gold, and then handing the gold over to the U.S. authorities in exchange for dollars. So on net, gold is being drained out of Great Britain and it's going into the United States. Okay, so that's. I'm just showing you like the microeconomics of it, why if the one country's inflating too much, it gives an incentive for people to start what would be considered attacking that currency, you know, turning in that currency for gold. Okay, what about different possible exchange, or sorry, currency regime would be flexible fiat currencies? And here, ironically enough, if you had to pick one economist who really wrote and made the case for this, it's Milton Friedman. And in case some of you guys are curious as to, you know, why is that Murray Rothbard seems to have it out for Milton Friedman? Well, come on, in a grand scheme, you know, isn't Milton Friedman a great champion of liberty? So why is Rothbard and Walter Block and some of these Austrians, why are they always... Why does it seem like they're going out of their way to pick on poor old Milton? Well, it's because some of the stuff for which Friedman is most famous was really bad from an Austro-libertarian point of view. And moreover, you know, this is supposed to be Friedman's specialty. You know, Friedman, yeah, wrote on all kinds of stuff, but where, you know, his area of expertise is supposed to be on monetary theory. And so it's from a Rothbardian viewpoint, Friedman is absolutely awful, and he had his worst, you know, contributions to economic thought in the area of monetary theory. So famously, Friedman said the reason the Great Depression was so bad is that the Fed didn't inflate enough in the early 30s, that if only the Fed had created more dollars, then things would have been a lot better, and we wouldn't have had the Great Depression. And then now, in terms of flexible fiat currencies, Milton Friedman, in a famous essay, you really started the ball rolling on how do mainstream economists analyze currencies, and Friedman made a very strong case for flexible fiat currencies. And it's funny, I read that essay when I was younger, before I understood how the classical gold standard worked, and I came away thinking Friedman was a genius. Like, he makes it look like if you believe in free markets, well then, duh, you obviously have to be in favor of flexible exchange rates. And so Friedman uses very nice rhetorical arguments like saying, just like you wouldn't, you know, as a free market economist, you wouldn't want there to be a fixed price of tobacco or of, I forget what to use, some commodity, you know, fixed price of wheat or oil. Well, by the same token, why should there be a fixed exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and the British pound? That's crazy. Why would you do that? If supply and demand change, then let the price change. And, you know, when he's walking you through it like that, you're like, oh, yeah, that's great. And, you know, I can come up with, for all of the standard reasons that you think freely floating prices are good and they're just transmitting information about the state of the world and about the state of supply and demand, Friedman's saying, you know, flexible currency regime is the optimal thing to do. So, you know, let's say you got two countries and one of them is inflating more than the other one, and so that trade deficit develops, like I said. Well, how does Friedman fix that? Well, he says the country that's inflating more, their country depreciates against the currency of the country that's not inflating. So in that example I said before, with, you know, the Bank of England printing too many pounds, and so at the original exchange rate, now all of a sudden British goods are more expensive than American goods, and so the British start importing more stuff from the United States than vice versa. That doesn't just happen forever. It's not like the country that's willing to print more gets everyone's goodies indefinitely. No, Friedman would say that, well, what happens is on the foreign exchange market, the pound depreciates against the dollar. So even though prices quoted in British pounds on stickers in Great Britain are going up, because now the pound trades for fewer dollars than it used to, those low American prices are relatively higher to the people in Great Britain. Because now, let's give you an example. So let's say originally the US dollar and the British pound traded 1-to-1. Just keep things simple. And there was something in the United States that cost $100 and something in Great Britain that cost 100 pounds. And now the Bank of England just starts going nuts, printing pounds. So all the prices in England or Great Britain double. So now that thing that originally cost 100 pounds costs 200 pounds. So at first it looks like, well, duh, the people in Great Britain are going to buy all that stuff from the United States because it only costs $100, whereas now it costs 200 pounds. But what happens, of course, is in the new equilibrium, the pound, you know, 1 pound exchanges for $2 instead of it being 1-to-1. So even though that thing costs $100 in the United States still, to somebody in Great Britain, they need to give up 200 pounds to get it. Because they have to give up 200 pounds in the foreign exchange market to get $100, and then they can go buy that thing. Okay, so that's what Friedman is saying, is that flexible exchange rates don't give an advantage to a country that debases its currency. It just shows up, you know, quickly shows up in the foreign exchange markets, and so there's, you know, very fleeting benefits at best from the inflating. And then the problems arise. If we think about fiat currencies with exchange controls. Okay, so back when I read Friedman's essay when I was in high school and was thought it was very compelling, and I walked away thinking, oh yeah, fixed exchange rate, that's crazy. How could anybody who believes in the market and understands free market economics possibly favor a regime of fixed exchange rates? Because what I was thinking of was actual, you know, government price fixing. In the conventional sense of the term. So you know, here the stereotype would be some South American dictator who's using inflation to cover his budget deficit, and that would normally make his currency weaken against foreign currencies, but the dictator doesn't want that to happen. So he just says unilaterally to his people, if I catch any of you buying foreign, you know, offering more of our currency for foreign currency than the officially accepted price, I'll chop your head off. And so, yeah, he can do that, but, and that will keep the so-called market exchange rate of the domestic currency against foreign currencies within the desired range, but then there's a currency crisis that foreign currencies disappear. Because, you know, no foreigner is going to convert his currency to the local one at the unrealistic exchange rate that the dictator says. So people in the dictator's country, if they want to import stuff now, it's very difficult to do that because they're not legally allowed to offer enough of their own currency to get foreigners to give them their currency so that they can import the stuff from the foreign countries. And so then... so to make that work, the government has to have exchange controls, and they strictly regulate what people can import and all sorts of things like that. Right, so when Friedman was writing about the benefits of a flexible fiat currency regime, yeah, he was right if the thing you're contrasting it with is fiat currencies where, you know, the governments then just arbitrarily try to fix the exchange rates. So that's true. But again, to stress that Friedman's argument, you know, he hasn't shown that his system is better than the classical gold standard where there was fixed exchange rates, because again, the way those were maintained was not through compulsion, but from the government, from each respective government restraining itself and saying, we're going to redeem our currency for this much weight of gold. And then that's why that implied in turn fixed exchange rates among other currencies. So that's the thing. Let me just make sure you guys get that, that under the classical gold standard, there were foreign exchange markets that were free, right? So the price is determined there, like how many, you know, the British pound against the U.S. dollar. Foreign exchange dealers set those prices, you know, or those prices were set by supply and demand, even under the classical gold standard. But the point is, because each government had these policies in place that made it so that if the market price, the freely floating market price, deviated significantly one way or the other, then that would set in motion arbitrage opportunities that would push it back towards the anchor price. Okay, so strictly speaking, you did have flexible exchange rates under the classical gold standard, but the reason people would refer to it as fixed exchange rates is for the reason I'm giving you. Okay, so let's talk about the neoclassical theory of optimal currency area. And again, this is what we're doing right now, is the most theoretical part of this entire course. So the godfather here is Robert Mundell, Nobel laureate. He's actually a very free market guy. Okay, Arthur Laffer and he were collaborators, and Mundell has been called by many the father of supply side economics. Now, you could argue and say maybe Arthur Laffer should have that title, but clearly the two of them are very free market economists. They are not Keynesians. They think that, you know, in general, yep, the government should cut spending and lower tax rates, and that's the way you promote economic growth, and that, you know, they're against lots of government regulations and so forth. But again, ironically, just like with Milton Friedman, Robert Mundell, even though in general he's a free market guy, he is the, you know, father of this analysis of how do you determine the optimal boundaries of a fiat currency. I was looking for to see if there was any kind of material I could give you guys that Mundell has written, but a lot of it got a little bit too technical, I think. So that's why I gave you that Krugman piece. So I'm stressing the stuff about Mundell because I want you to realize, even though I'm giving you Krugman's piece to give you the flavor of this, it's not just left-wing liberal Keynesians who subscribe to this viewpoint. It's actually guys that are considered like hard right-wingers by many economists, such as Robert Mundell and Arthur Laffer also would endorse. You know, he might not agree with every last conclusion, but this framework, you know, Arthur Laffer certainly is on board with this kind of analysis. Okay, so let me back up for a second. What they're trying to do is they're trying to say, what is the optimal currency area? Because it doesn't necessarily coincide with political boundaries. So in a sense, when all the nations of the world were on gold, you could argue that there was one global currency that transcended national boundaries. And so they're saying, okay, in the post-war era, we're no longer it's not like the whole world's using gold. We had these different currencies, and then for the post-war period for a while, the U.S. dollar was the reserve currency, and then other nations pegged their currencies to the dollar. And so what Mundell is trying to say is, you know, just theoretically as an economist here, how do we determine which areas ought to fall under the umbrella or the jurisdiction of a single fiat currency? Because obviously you know that it'd be crazy if every single person has his or her own unique currency, right? If I just walked around paying my bills with Robert Murphy's and Jeff Tucker walked around paying his bills with Jeff Tucker's and so forth, you know, that'd be crazy. We wouldn't be, that would be barter, right? There wouldn't be a money if that's what we were doing. On the other hand, is it correct to say that the whole world should use one single fiat currency issued by a world central bank? Well, that also is not obvious that that's the case. So that's the kind of thing that Robert Mundell was trying to solve just theoretically using, you know, standard mainstream neoclassical tools. And obviously he wasn't the only one to contribute to this literature, but he's considered the pioneer, and that's what his Nobel Prize is for. Okay, so there's two main considerations that people in this area stress when they're talking about this. So one is labor mobility. And that's one difference between the United States and Europe is that the United States, there's very low barriers to internal migration. So if Paul Krugman in his piece talks about Nevada, that right now was doing very poorly after the housing bubble burst, right? Because in Las Vegas in particular, real estate prices went through the roof and then they collapsed. So the housing bubble hit, in terms of at the state level, hit Nevada much harder than it hit a lot of other U.S. states. And so you would expect initially unemployment to be much higher, you know, all the laid off construction workers, all of the subsidiary things following from that, you know, that there would need to be more, there'd be more activity in the casinos and so forth because of the construction workers who moved to Las Vegas and all that kind of stuff. So then when the thing blows up, Nevada is hit much, much harder than other states. So unemployment originally would surge much higher in Nevada than it would in other states. But since labor is relatively mobile in the United States, there was like an escape valve that the displaced workers just moved to other states. And so that allows, you know, so Nevada doesn't get strained with all these unemployed workers because they can just go elsewhere. And it's not just legal barriers, you know, so it's not just that other states can't literally have legal obstacles to U.S. citizens crossing their boundaries and moving into their territory, but also culturally, the barriers to internal migration are much lower in the United States than in Europe because, you know, the U.S. has a common language. I mean, yeah, there's different dialects, but somebody can move from New York down to Texas or vice versa, and people can understand each other. You know, if you want to go take a job in a state that's on the other side of the country, even though you might be going 2,000 miles away, it's basically the same culture. Whereas in Europe, if you lose your job wherever you were and you move 2,000 miles away, or however many kilometers it would be, you know, it could be an entirely different culture. People are speaking a different language. The work schedules are different, and just the cultural traditions are totally different. So it'd be a lot harder for you to find work 2,000 miles away from where you lost your job. Whereas the United States, that is a possibility. You just get into a U-Haul and get on the road. Okay, so that's one major component of this, and this is particularly with what Mundell stressed. He was saying that when you're trying to figure out, you know, the optimal size of a region that's going to use a single currency, one of the things you want to see is that there's low barriers to internal migration within that region. So that if some event hits one spot, causing high unemployment and so forth, that they can just move elsewhere. Right, so already, just to give you the big picture, what I'm trying to show you is this is why Krugman and a lot of the other critics were saying standard economic theory shows that the Euro project was doomed to fail. That it was wrong for these elites to say, let's emulate the United States. The U.S. has the dollar, so we should have the euro. Because there were significant differences between the U.S. and Europe that should have warned them that even though, it's a good idea for the U.S. to have a common currency, it's not obvious that it's good for Europe to all have a common currency. And so this is one of the huge differences. Another difference, this one's not stressed so much by Mundell, but by other more Keynesian people in this tradition, is that you want to have, if you have a common currency area, you want to have fiscal integration at the, among the regions. So here the idea is, Krugman would argue, the reason a common currency works so well in the United States but not so well in Europe is that in the U.S., when certain bad economic events happen to isolated regions, they can share that loss with everyone throughout the whole area because they have this integrated government fiscal arrangement. So, again, go back to Nevada. When Nevada gets hit hard when the housing bubble bursts, we already talked about one thing as part of what eases that problem is that it's relatively easy for the unemployed workers in Nevada to leave the state and go elsewhere. So that takes the pressure off Nevada. But also, there's called the automatic stabilizers. So people in Nevada are getting unemployment checks, food stamps, things like that from the U.S. government. And that's not just a wash, because other people in other states are still paying their taxes to Washington. The people in Nevada, because now they're unemployed, their tax payments have dropped. And since Nevada, by assumption, we're saying it got hit harder than a lot of the other places, on net now, Nevada is redistributing income from their neighbors, at least more than they were before the economic disaster hit. Okay, so again, in neoclassical mainstream terms, and here especially from a Keynesian twist, they're trying to show if you have this situation where the various regions that are all falling under this common currency have this fiscal integration, that can make the project viable. Whereas in Europe, that's not the case. You have different fiscal policy and different automatic safety net, social safety net programs for the specific countries. And so, it's a problem that if you have one country that has very generous benefits, then when there's here's what the problem is. So when Spain gets hit hard, and so now Spanish unemployment goes way up, it's not that all of the European nations have to kick in with their taxpayers and fund the welfare benefits, unemployment benefits, and so forth go into the Spanish workers who are unemployed. It's the Spanish government has to deal with that, but the Spanish government can't do it because their tax revenue is down. See the idea? So the idea is you're not able to share the pain with other people, and so that's why, again, it's another reason from Krugman's viewpoint that Europe and the United States are not the same when it comes to the benefits of having a common currency. So let me just give you the big picture here. Krugman says, he's got a nice little thing saying, okay, let's call it Brooklyn versus Iceland. And he says that, so here Krugman's trying to deal with the objections that some of his readers were giving him. In his blog over time, he was going over this analysis. He kept repeating in various versions of it, saying why using standard optimal currency analysis, you could see that the European countries were in trouble and why Iceland was doing better. So let me, I gave you a link to that stuff. That was one of the readings, but let me make sure you get that part of the argument. So there, what they were saying is the reason Iceland is bouncing back and is doing okay, and the reason Ireland can't, and the reason, you know, if Spain starts really going and getting in trouble or Greece starts getting in trouble, the reason those countries are so in such dire straits, whereas Iceland actually is okay now, or at least is doing relatively better, is that Iceland has its own currency. And so Iceland had the luxury, had the option of devaluing its currency against all the other currencies, and so now it can continue to export goods and services. And so that's how it could deal with this this problem. In contrast, in Greece or Spain or Ireland, they can't unilaterally devalue their currency because they're part of this currency union. They're all using the euro, and so the Germans won't let them debase the euro. That's the idea. Like they're being blocked because of German obstinance. And so, given that now you're in a country where you have high unemployment, and again you've got barriers. It's the people in Ireland can't easily move elsewhere, or not as easily as the people in Nevada can move if they lose their jobs, or in Spain and what have you. And given that their respective governments can't just run huge budget deficits and or can't have huge spending to offset it because their tax revenues are way down. Whereas again in Nevada, there is that distinction because if Nevada's tax rep payments are down, so what? The tax payments from all the other states are still okay, and so the federal government can afford to give them more money. So the issue is, well, how are we gonna regain competitiveness? How are we gonna have our economy recover? And the answer is, well, if you have high unemployment, what needs to happen? Well, the wages need to come down. Or if you're having trouble exporting goods, what happens? Well, you got to have prices come down to make your goods relatively cheaper to induce foreigners to want to buy them. Or if your workers now can't find a job, well, you have to make them cheaper. But if you're a Keynesian, you're saying that's tough because there's nominal rigidities. It's hard to get workers in Ireland to accept 10% cuts across the board in their wages. Or it's hard if exports are way down. It's hard to get every producer, manufacturer in your country to cut prices by 10% in order to make them more competitive. It's tricky to do that. And then on top of all that, Krugman says, if people are really indebted, well, then it's even worse if you try to have your prices fall, because then that just makes the real burden of the debt that much higher. So Krugman says, rather than having to go through that and just grind through years and years of falling prices that the trade unions are resisting and so forth, you could fix things really quickly if you can just devalue your currency. So then people don't have to, the workers don't have to change the wages they're asking for, and the producers don't need to lower their sticker price. If your currency can just fall against all the other currencies, well, now all of a sudden your goods are cheaper for everybody else. And so you could start exporting more, and from your firm's perspective, world demand for your exports has gone up. And so now they can afford to start hiring those workers again, and your country has an export boom and pulls out of the recession. So that's why they're saying Iceland was fortunate because it had its own sovereign currency that it could devalue. And that was the way Iceland pulled out of the huge disaster that hit it. Whereas Ireland doesn't have that option. Ireland can't devalue its own currency because it's part of the, it's using the euro. That's the idea. So that's the kind of stuff Krugman was talking about. So then his reader, the critics of him were saying, what are you talking about, Krugman? Okay, using your arguments then, Brooklyn would, why doesn't Brooklyn have its own currency, right? Because Brooklyn's probably got more people than Iceland does, and I'm pretty sure it does. So you know, why, if you just think that you just proved that Iceland's doing well because it has an isolated currency and that Ireland was dumb to sign on and to join the euro zone or, you know, to use the euro, then is Brooklyn, are the people in Brooklyn dumb for using the U.S. dollar? Okay, so that was the thing. So let me just explain to you how Krugman dealt with that. He says, okay, here's the deal. There's other differences between Brooklyn and Iceland. So no, Krugman's saying, I don't agree that the people in Brooklyn are dumb for using a dollar. But I can use, you know, the theory of optimal currency area can show me why that reductio ad absurdum doesn't hold. So he says, when you ask what are the costs and benefits of using a common currency, he says, well, one of the benefits of having a common currency is that it reduces transaction costs. And so in Brooklyn, if they try to use something other than the dollar, and, you know, if they try to use the Brooklyn note or something, that would be very inconvenient because they don't do all their business internally. They do a lot of business with people who are in other boroughs and other parts of the United States outside of New York City. And so it would be very inconvenient if every time somebody in Brooklyn, you know, worked in Manhattan and got paid in dollars and then wanted to buy stuff in stores in Brooklyn and had to go and exchange his dollars for Brooklyn notes. That would be a real pain. And also, it would be hard for the people in Brooklyn to plan their business operations. You know, so if a convenience store in Brooklyn on a street corner gets its, you know, beer and Slim Jims and everything else shipped in from New Jersey, let's say, and New Jersey, of course, is on the dollar, well, then in Brooklyn, you know, they're selling their prices in Brooklyn notes, and that's what their revenues are consistent. It's hard for them to plan because if the exchange rate between the Brooklyn note and the dollar moves, then all of a sudden the price of their inputs can change significantly. Okay, or going the other way, if people live in Brooklyn but work in Manhattan on Wall Street, so their salaries are paid in terms of dollars, well, then if the exchange rate moves, what they thought they were getting paid all of a sudden might not be as much, not because their employer cut their pay, but because the exchange rate moved. Okay, so that's the idea that one of the arguments for having a common currency is you want to minimize transaction costs. It's very inconvenient to have to keep switching currencies. And so if you've got a bunch of people that trade a lot with each other, that's an argument, other things equal, for having all those people using the same currency. So Krugman is saying that the economic integration of people who live in Brooklyn is much higher than the economic integration with their surrounding area or neighbors of the people who live in Iceland. But yeah, people in Iceland, you know, it's not autarky. They still trade with the rest of the world, but not nearly as much as the residents of Brooklyn trade with the other members of the United States. Okay, so that's the idea. So that's one huge difference. And then, like I said, then those other factors that I talked about before, you know, Krugman would roll into that. Okay, so that's the way the mainstream economists approach this. And like I said, that's why so many of them were skeptical of the European project. And in fairness, I should say this isn't just these economists after the fact saying, oh, we know why the euro is having trouble right now. Because actually a lot of these economists were on record saying from the get-go, this is not going to work. And what's funny is, I don't know if Paul Krugman was. He may have been, I don't know. But I think actually he was. And what's funny is there was a paper that came out, it was in the journal, I think, Econ Journal Watch, that I think Dan Klein is the editor of that and some other. And so this article came out, I want to say, like as late as 2007 or maybe even 2008. I mean, it was pretty late that it came out, making fun of all the people who were critics of the euro. So that, you know, that was the point of the article. Like, these people the authors of the article that was in this journal went back through the years and culled quotes from people who were saying the Euro project was going to blow up in their faces. And the point of the article was to make fun of these people and say, aha, look, at they thought the Euro was going to collapse, but hey, we're, you know, 10 years into this thing and it's fine so far. And then, you know, within months or maybe a year of that article coming out, you have the sovereign debt crisis and people are wondering, is the Euro going to survive this? So it's kind of funny that just the timing of that. Okay, in the remaining time here, and I'll turn to your questions, let's look at the Austrian perspective. So I was trying to figure out, to find something analogous to Mundell's work on optimal currency area in the Austrian tradition. You know, I was trying to find or think through, gee, have I ever read anything by Mises or Rothbard talking about what the optimal jurisdiction or region of a currency is? And I couldn't, you know, nothing was really coming to mind. I mean, I could think of a few scattered remarks here and there, but nothing was really coming to mind. And I realized part of it is it wouldn't even occur to the Austrians to talk like that, because the mainstream economists, they're thinking in terms of advising political organizations, you know, various governments as to how to arrange themselves and which, you know, which government should ally with each other and then foist a fiat currency on their subjects. And so it's a matter of providing advice to all these, you know, central planners in terms of money. And so obviously it's not that you could say, okay, well, Robert Mundell has this sort of advice, words of wisdom for all the political leaders around the world as to which, you know, which one should get together and have their own fiat currency and have their own central bank based on it. See, and then, oh, and over here, this is what Mises would say. You know, that's, that kind of thing doesn't really happen, because that's not even the way they would think. What is true is that I know that Rothbard and I think Mises also, you know, have talked about just explaining in a market economy, if all the world were a giant market economy, what sort of forces would be at play? And so, you know, you would have, there would be this tendency for currency integration, if that's what you want to call it, for people that do a lot of trading with each other. And that's why you saw that the gold standard, you know, or gold in general, just started sweeping the world, that merchants around the world naturally gravitated towards gold, and the ball started rolling in that direction, and then, you know, also using silver. And so there, I mean, the prediction would be, even if governments weren't involved at all, that as more and more countries, or regions, I should say, became integrated into the global economy, they would switch over to gold. So the issue, I mean, so it's not to say that everybody is all going to use the same thing as money. Obviously, there's some isolated aboriginal tribe somewhere that has no contact with the rest of the world. Maybe they're going to use beaver pelts or something as their money, and that's good for them to do. And, you know, if they don't have, especially if they don't have any gold there, obviously they're not going to use gold. And there's nothing in Austrian economics saying that's inefficient or that, oh, they really ought to switch over. But the point is that once they do start trading with people, they, you know, they may find it advantageous to switch over, and that would just be a matter of individual voluntary choice. And it, you know, it's sort of like it would fix itself. Like if you try to just start explaining the pros and cons, it's not that you need the political authorities to do the right thing. You know, if it makes sense for the people in this region to all start using gold, because that's what the rest of the world does, and that would minimize transaction costs, then they will start using gold. You know, so first what would happen is, of course, the merchants, the ones who deal directly with the outsiders, they would start using gold and beaver pelts. But then if it, you know, if, for example, just the people recognize that the gold was a better medium of exchange than beaver pelts for various reasons, maybe other people that dealt with the merchants would start acquiring gold and beaver pelts because they, you know, dealt with the merchants so much, and they knew that the merchants would always accept gold, and it was really easy to store the gold and so forth compared to the beaver pelts. And, you know, gold had a more convenient purchasing power per unit weight than the beaver pelts, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, that it was more uniform for all the reasons that gold was a superior money for the people that did a lot of business with those merchants, they also might start stockpiling gold. And then that, you know, it just might filter out. So my point is, when you start specifying, well, what are the pros and cons, those things would just naturally shake themselves out. And so would that region eventually just be using gold and not using beaver pelts anymore? And I think you would find that once you specified the various considerations, that yes, they would, if it was the right thing to do. If that was the efficient outcome, that's what eventually would happen. And if it weren't the, you know, the efficient outcome, if it's just because the people were so used to using beaver pelts and it was just very rare that there would be these, you know, big shipments of stuff from the outside world, and it was just, you know, sort of one-off transactions where the merchants who were doing the importing used gold to deal with, you know, the pale-faced devils and so forth, but the local community didn't really interact with those people, really, and they could just get along fine using their beaver pelts like they always had, well, then there would be no reason to change, and they wouldn't change. Okay, so it's with the Mondellian thing with Krugman, I mean, that's part of what's going on. The Krugman piece is he's saying, oh, no, we elites, they made the wrong decision. Ah, I can't believe it. Now the, you know, Europe's paying for their mistake. Whereas if you have freedom, then people just spontaneously go and they choose the thing that works, and you don't have to worry about, oh, my gosh, what if they choose the wrong thing, because everybody's weighing the pros and cons, and, you know, that the market outcome is going to be the right thing to do, just like you generally give that presumption in other areas besides the jurisdiction of a particular money. Okay, let me walk you through Mises' plan for returning to sound money. So there is a lot of stuff that Mises talks about in that piece I gave you, and of course you should read all of that, but let me just make sure you got this aspect of it. This is the thing where it will probably help you guys if I go over it. So what he talks about, and I just want to clarify for you guys, so Mises was writing this, where this thing came from was from the theory of money and credit, but it was a collection, you know, part that was added afterward. Right, so the, you know, original book came out early, and then this thing was added. I think it was in the 1950s that this particular essay was written. Okay, so this was not the original theory of money and credit. So here, but when this is written, we're under the Bretton Woods arrangement. So here, the United States technically still had the dollar pegged to gold, now at $35 an ounce, while the rest of the world, you know, they still would hold gold, some of the central banks, but strictly speaking, they were encouraged by the U.S. authorities to not hold gold anymore, but to use dollars as the reserves. So that's why Mises, in this treatment, has one section devoted to currency reform in Ruritania, which is just, you know, his name for a fictitious small country that's been debasing its currency. And then he's got another section for how does it, you know, what does the United States need to do? So there, what Mises is talking about for the U.S. at the time he's writing this essay, the U.S. dollar is still technically redeemable for gold by other central banks. The average citizen, Joe Blow, can't go into the up to the Treasury or the Fed and say, "Hey, here's $35 in currency, give me an ounce of gold." They're going to say, "Get lost." But if the Bank of France calls up and says, "Hey, we want to give you $35, give us an ounce of gold," they're going to have to do that. So for Mises, this is a far cry from the classical gold standard. And so that's what Mises is talking about there, is he's trying to show, I don't want this thing where all Americans use green pieces of paper and aren't actually holding gold coins. I want the U.S. to go back to the classical gold standard. So that's what he's advising there, in case you're confused, because the U.S. was not on a fiat system at that point. But for our purposes now, the thing that actually is relevant is what is Mises' advice for a country that had completely abandoned gold, this fictitious country, Ruritania, because now at this point, even the United States is no longer on gold at all. So what he says is, the first thing you need to do is Ruritania, the Ruritanian authorities, they need to stop printing money. And so he calls it the Rur, R-U-R, the domestic currency. So they need to stop printing Rurs. But beyond that, they also need to stop the further creation of what's called fiduciary media. So that means, if you're familiar with monetary aggregates like M1, M2, M3, what those include, when you say, like, what's the quantity of money in the United States, how many dollars exist, if you say, well, like M1, what's the size of M1, that includes not only the green pieces of paper, like $20 bills, $100 bills, and so forth, but also the public's total checking account balances or demand deposits. And so some of that stuff is unbacked, right, because we have a fraction reserve banking system. So that number is bigger than just the actual green pieces of paper that are in circulation if you add in all of the checking account balances, because the banks, the commercial banks, can issue more loans than they have and demand deposits than they have green pieces of paper in the vaults backing it up. So Mises is saying, I want to cap, to put a ceiling on the total quantity of RURs. So not only just the paper RURs that the Ruritanian government or central bank is issuing, but even the commercial banks in Ruritania, it is now illegal for them to issue any more, you know, as a temporary measure. You can't issue any more. So you can't make new loans. You can only just roll over loans. So if some customer pays off his mortgage, you can grant a new mortgage to somebody else, but you can't inflate anymore, because I want to cap the total amount of RURs in existence. So once he does that, okay, now the RUR is going to finally stop sinking against other currencies, and the price of gold quoted in RURs is going to stop going up. Because the idea is Mises is giving advice to a country that's in trouble. So before, the country, you know, was run by a tin pot dictator, it had big budget deficits, and it was just running the printing press, printing up new RURs to fund the government's expenses. And so the RUR is constantly falling against other currencies, and the price of gold quoted in RURs kept going up and up and up. So Mises is saying, first of all, we got to stop that. So put the brakes on the new creation of RURs. Then you wait till the, you know, investors around the world, speculators, see that you're serious and that there's a new, you know, there's a new sheriff in town, and eventually the price of the RUR will stabilize. The RUR will stop falling against the dollar, against the mark, against, you know, responsible currencies, and the price of gold will stop rising in terms of RURs. And then once it starts going the other way, because remember, all the other countries of the world are still inflating. And so if once Ruritania commits to being a hard money country and people realize that, then the RUR is finally going to start appreciating against other currencies. So Mises says, once you see that, once you're convinced there really is a change in the trend, and that now the RUR, if you did nothing else, was going to, you know, start more and more appreciating, he says, okay, that's now the market exchange rate that I want you to lock in forever. So Mises talks about tying it to the dollar, but he was doing that because the dollar at the time was tied to gold. So I think just for our purposes, just we can interpret Mises as saying, now, once you're sure that the RUR has been stabilized in terms of the gold price, lock that in forever. And from now on, whatever the market price was of, you know, how many RURs traded for 1 ounce of gold, you lock that in. So now your monetary authority, and Mises, you know, talks about giving it independence and so forth. What they do is they stand prepared to issue new paper RURs anytime someone presents them an ounce of gold. And vice versa, if somebody gives them RURs, they will give them an ounce of gold at this now fixed exchange rate. And so what happens is over time, now the quantity of RURs can expand, but only when people bring more gold and hand it over to the Ruritanian Monetary Authority. The commercial banks can't expand anymore. they can only issue new deposits if people deposit RURs with them on a 100% reserve basis. And the RUR, you know, only paper RURs can now only be issued new ones if there's 100% gold deposits in the government vaults or the monetary authority's vaults backing it up. So over time, the RUR moves closer and closer to being 100% backed by gold. It's not ever going to be 100% backed by gold, because at the moment when this reform takes place, there are a lot more RURs floating around than there are gold reserves held by the government. But the point is, since we stopped it there, and then now, as any new, you know, any new RURs that are created are backed 100% over time, you know, the proportion of total RURs to total gold reserves gets closer and closer to 100%. And so that's the idea. So the benefit of this thing is it moves you, you know, it moves you back in the direction of a fully gold-backed currency, which Mises thinks is ideal. And there's no painful deflation that's necessary. It takes the market price and locks that in. So a lot of proposals to go back on gold involve painful adjustment processes. This doesn't involve any of that. It is just, how do we quickly just lock in things now? You know, let bygones be bygones. The RUR it's gonna take a lot more RURs to buy an ounce of gold now at this new official rate than it did historically before the government started printing RURs like crazy. But Mises says, you know, that's the genie's already out of the bottle. You can't go back. Let's just be responsible going forward. And this makes sense. So he has a nice little discussion there. I don't have time to go over too carefully about the choice of the redemption rate. And so in the United States, for example, from now, like let's say the Americans wanted to go back on gold. They wanted to tie the dollar back to gold. That would raise the question of which price do we choose. And so what Mises is saying is you just take the current market price. And so all you're doing now is tying the hands of the Fed going forward to make sure that any new dollars that are issued are backed 100% by gold at the current market price. It would be silly, and there'd be no purpose in going back to some previous thing. Like, it would be crazy, Mises would argue, if right now we tried to tie the dollar back to gold at the rate of $35 an ounce, which it was when Nixon closed the gold window in 71. It would be even crazier to try to go back to $20.67 an ounce, which it was in 1933 when FDR first, you know, abandoned the gold standard and confiscated everyone's gold. Because there has been so much inflation since then that in order to go back, you know, there would have to be this really painful contraction of the money supply. They'd have to destroy 90% of the dollars out there. And that would just be, you know, very disruptive. And Mises saying, why go through that? He said, moreover, you wouldn't even be benefiting the same people that you originally harmed. So the idea is part of the reason people want to go back is they're going to say, oh, well, when FDR reneged on the gold standard, there were a bunch of people who, you know, he really defrauded. And Mises says, yeah, that's true. But now if we made the dollar really strengthen, and so creditors got this huge windfall and debtors got this huge pain foisted on them, he's saying you're not benefiting the people that you harmed, that FDR harmed, that, you know, obviously, because those people are dead, and you're not even necessarily benefiting their heirs, because if their heirs switched out of dollar denominated debts and got into something else, they're not benefiting but from it. So the point is, the people who right now happen to be creditors in terms of dollars, who would benefit greatly if the government had a very deflationary policy that pushed the market price of gold back to $35 an ounce, those people weren't the ones, or even the heirs of the ones, who were harmed by the inflation. So Mises is saying, instead of just having another wave of a massive redistribution of wealth by a huge deflation, don't do that. You can go back to the benefits of a gold standard immediately if you just do this plan that I'm talking about right here. Okay, so let me turn over to your questions now. While I'm pulling this up, let me just say to you guys, I've been traveling a lot, and so that's why I haven't yet caught up on all of your questions from week one. But I still am going to do that. It's not that I've forgotten about them. I've just been had a crazy traveling schedule. Okay, where are we? Okay, William says, do you think Paul Krugman is going to be happy and tell everyone that Hurricane Irene is going to spark economic growth on the East Coast? Laugh out loud. Well, it's funny. I don't know when you posted that hoax had been that was actually the earthquake, right? So what is funny is this issue of are natural disasters good for the economy? And for those of you who don't know, what happened is, you know how there was that mild earthquake on the East Coast, I don't know if it was 10 days ago, something like that. Somebody on Google Plus was pretending to be Paul Krugman and said, you know, people are making jokes about it, but actually, in all seriousness, if the earthquake had done more damage, then that would have stimulated spending and hence helped employment or something like that. And I think that's totally true on Krugman's worldview. Like that's obvious. That's totally consistent with things he said. But Krugman, of course, went ballistic and got real self-righteous and said, you know, if you read some quote that's stupid and outrageous attributed to me, maybe you should check with me first if it's not run by the New York Times or something. And so it's funny. Krugman was making it sound like he thought that was an outrageous statement, but yet, like I say, is actually less outrageous than plenty of things that he has said. For example, after 9/11, Krugman said that as ghastly as it might seem to talk about dollars and cents after a tragedy like this, there's actually two good economic effects that might result. And he went on to talk about those good economic effects that the 9/11 attacks would spawn. So it's, anyway, that whole episode of natural disasters and Krugman's funny because he was trying to, in my view, run away from the obvious implications of his policy. Let me just say just one little nitpicky thing. There is a distinction we should be careful between someone saying if a natural disaster causes a bunch of damage when we have a depressed economy, the fact that it will spur more employment means the gross damage, the actual damages aren't as bad the original thing might have suggested versus saying it's good overall that the earthquake happened. Okay, so I reject both parts of the analysis. I think that, no, it's never, there's no sense in which it's good if people are made poorer because property is destroyed. But I'm just saying some of these Keynesians are getting real anal about it and saying, no, Krugman never said it's good that they're, you know, that for the economy. He's just saying it's not as bad because there's these offsetting benefits, but still on net it's bad. So, and Krugman being the slippery fellow that he is, I've never seen him definitively say one way or the other which of those positions he's taking. But clearly he's saying at the very least there are some good things that can happen when there's a natural disaster in terms of the economy, even if he's not being explicit about are those good things so good that they overwhelm the bad things such that you're glad after the fact that the disaster happened, that we're richer because of the disaster than we otherwise would have been. I've never seen Krugman clearly say one way or the other. Okay. Senthil is asking me about the Lebanese Central Bank, but I don't know that off the top of my head, so I would have to look at that article, but I will do that and get back to you. Okay, Gary says, that's a good one. Do labor rates in a common currency union move toward equality absent restrictions on the free flow of capital? For example, what would happen to labor rates in the U.S. and Mexico if both countries adopted a common currency without imposing capital controls? That's a good question, Gary. Maybe I'll change my answer if I think about it some more, but off the top of my head, and we're just about out of time here, so this will be the last question. Off the top of my head, though, I'm not sure that the things you're talking about are really going to be that relevant for labor rate. I mean, I think the primary thing for wage rates is going to be immigration barriers, that if you allow people to move from Mexico to the U.S. freely, then you're going to see, yeah, for especially unskilled labor, the wages are going to go down, and so you have inequality. That workers in Mexico are going to keep moving to the United States so long as the relative pay is higher in the United States, and they wouldn't stop until wages were a lot closer than they are right now. They wouldn't necessarily need to be equal, because if you're living in Mexico and you just speak Spanish and you grew up in Mexico, you would have a preference for living there, I'm assuming, or at least a lot of people would. And so, it's not that it would have to literally be, but the point is you couldn't be making a lot more in the United States for doing the same kind of work you're doing in Mexico. No, because again, too, it's scary to move to a new country. So a lot of people don't want to do that. They'd rather live where they know and grew up. But the point is that there's these huge disparities in pay for the same job, then yeah, you're going to see a flow of workers until that disparity gets narrowed. So whether or not they had a common currency, that would still be true, so long as the wage rates adjusted for the exchange rate. So even if the U.S. is still using the dollar and Mexico is still using the peso, if you had totally open borders in terms of immigration, you would see a tendency towards equality and wage rates for the same type of labor. When you say, what do you mean by the same? Obviously, if labor is earning a certain amount per hour in dollars and a certain amount per hour in pesos, the way you compare those two numbers is you got to use the exchange rate. All right, so that would happen. And the same thing with the free flow of capital. I mean, the free flow of capital, yeah, that would influence labor a little bit, but that would more have to do with the returns to capital. That, if you can earn a higher rate of return on your investing $1 million in a factory in Mexico than you can in the United States, then why aren't you doing that? Other things equal, you're not worried about expropriation, all that. Well, if there's controls on the movement of capital across borders, well, that's one reason. Okay, so anyway, it's a good question, but my answer, like I say, unless you either want to clarify or if I think of something else, my answer right now is to say that, this way, having a common currency would get rid of capital controls. I mean, I guess you're right that technically those two things are distinct, but it would be a lot harder to maintain capital controls if these countries are all using the same currency. Whereas if they're using different currencies, it's a lot easier to have capital controls because you can catch people when they're trying to exchange one currency for the other. But in terms of wage rates, I think they're the primordial thing, the fundamental thing is movement of workers. Okay, well, we're out of time. We've got to stop there. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Like I say, this was the most theoretical of the weeks. And then we're later, next week and the following one will be more about me giving you news articles and things like that to read. Okay, and I will catch up with your questions, and I'll send out an email blast once I have the quiz for this week posted. All right, thanks, everybody. Oh, last thing. This Friday, September 2nd, I'm having a debate with Carl Smith. So if you haven't heard about that, you might want to check it out. There's a little blurb at the Mises blog on that, and it looks like it's probably going to be pretty entertaining. Because I picked Carl Smith. I asked him if he wanted to debate me, because he seemed like a fair guy in the past and he knew what he was talking about. But then I didn't realize he's kind of a wise guy too. So he put up a pretty funny blog post, basically saying he was going to bury me and restore justice to the world and everything. So if you haven't seen that, you might want to check out the Mises blog. There's also going to be a Mises Daily article running on Friday talking about it. But anyway, that debate is going to be this Friday, September 2nd, if you're curious.